Welcome to the first ever episode of Worth Playing, where we're playing a game and then talking about it, which means we don't have to outline an old TV show or movie. Today, we're talking about the just-released game Dragon's Dogma 2. I'm your host, and I've always been honest about the fact that I have no heart. My co-host is Guy, who occasionally gets uppity, and I have to throw him into the brine to teach him a lesson.
But if thou art the arisen, we shall meet again.
So, Guy, we're like the only people on the planet who'll spend 60 hours playing a game so we can avoid half an hour of outlining an old Doctor Who episode.
And that's, I was thinking, you know, when we've seen the Doctor Who episodes where the Doctor goes on vacation, so he's just missing from an episode, and when you go on vacation, we end up talking about a video game.
Yeah, that's true. I'm spending the week in San Francisco at the Silent Film Festival, and we just thought this would be a fun discussion to have. Also, I gotta say, you know, I'm always like way out there and too, you know, my goals are way ridiculous, and you're always like, why don't we just do this, right? So we talked about, early on, we talked about doing video games, like, well, to meet our, you know, the way our podcast works, we'd have to play through it all for dozens of hours and put it together and do this and that. And you're more like, well, why don't we just have a conversation about it, right? So at this point, yeah, I've kind of been ground down to agree with you. So like with Dragons and Dogma, we're just going to have a conversation. And I think every once in a while, a game that we both like or interested in or whatever, I think it's worth doing that with.
Yeah.
I mean, the one that I would like to do sometime, I don't know, you know, if I could get you to put some time into playing, it would be Hades, because I've put a huge amount of time into it.
Yeah. I did put some time into it, and I enjoyed it enough that I wouldn't mind going back to it. I wasn't super great at it, but I enjoyed it, and I liked the fact that every time you went around, the characters all had some new little bit of dialogue for you and stuff like that.
Well, and Hades taught me a lot about games and also some connections to Dragon's Dogma, as we'll see. But since this is our first gaming episode, I thought we should talk about our early gaming experiences and what video games mean to us. So what's, mean, you play, even though video games are huge to me, you play more video games than I do. So what's your background?
Yeah, probably. I started playing video games early. I mean, you know, I was born in 1970, so I was just a wee lad when, you know, Pong came out. I actually played a stand-up Pong machine in a bar up in Northern Michigan.
Wait, and, how old were you when you were in that bar?
pretty young. But you know, it was a bar called the Fog Cutter, and it was like the place where you would wait for the ferry to Drummond Island to come back and pick you up. So my parents would take me in there while we were waiting. Of course, they didn't let me drink at the time, but they did let me play Pong. And yeah, I mean, Space Invaders, you know, the whole nine yards. You know, I remember all the great Cedar Point Arcade still. Well, I haven't been to Cedar Point in probably a decade or more, but it used to be the Cedar Point Arcade. It had some of those great old 70s, 80s arcade games that were still playable. Yeah, I've been fascinated by video games for a long time. Then in, I think it was my seventh grade, which would have been the 82 to 83 school year. In my math class, I was in advanced math. We had a 2-week programming stint on the Apple II Plus. Mm-hmm. So I took to it like a duck to water because I'd been reading these video gaming magazines. Even back then, as primitive as the games were, they had magazines about video games and reviews and all that, like Castle Wolfenstein when it came out, the original Castle Wolfenstein, not the 3D one, but the one that was just like Berserk, a map on the screen, you know?
Right. I got it. Was the 2 Plus, did that have a shift key or not? Because what I always remember about when I worked on Apple computers early on, which is ironic because I eventually, you know, spent my career at Apple, they didn't have a shift key. They only had uppercase. And so on online forums, Apple people would annoy the crap out of everyone because all their
they were always shouting.
Yeah, they were shouting.
Yeah. Sure. You know, that Now that I think about it, I don't recall typing anything in lowercase on it. Now, the Commodore 64 and VIC-20, when they came out, they had it. But I think you're right.
The Commodore 64 was huge for games, right? I mean, I remember my first. So I was, my family was poor, but I lived in Bellevue with, you know, Microsoft country, et cetera. All my friends were rich, and they all got Commodore 64s. And that was the gaming platform. I'd go over to their house and play it, right? Because it had the graphics and the sound and everything. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had a VIC-20 for maybe a year or so, and then I got a 64. And that was my gaming computer up until the time that I got an Amiga. So between the two of them, I pretty much missed out on the Nintendo era, you know, the NES and the Super NES and all that. You know, my sister had one, so I ended up playing a few games on it, but that many.
Well, one of the things I regret in my gaming history is I was a PC gamer from the beginning, so I missed all the console stuff, and I missed all the many of the Japanese games that, you know, were a huge influence on everyone else. I missed them because they weren't on PC. To this day, I haven't played through many of, you know, those games, and I regret that. You know, as a huge video gamer, I'd like to understand the games that, you know, created the industry.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I did have an Atari 2600.
Oh, my God. I remember going over to friend's house for that, and he played like the space games where he's shooting the spaceships and all that. Oh, it was was huge. Yeah. Yeah.
And I even had a Coleco Telstar, which was this little thing about the size of a small, I don't know, I was going to say cutting board, but it was more elongated. So it had two dials on it. It was basically Pong, and you could sit next to a friend on the couch and, like, balance it on your lap so you could use one knob and the friend could use another one. That sounds like an invitation to some kind of decadence there, I guess. But anyway, it hooked up to your TV, but the sounds didn't go through the TV. The sounds, you put a 9-volt battery in it. That was what powered the whole thing, or maybe just the sounds. It might have also had an AC adapter. But anyway, the sounds came out of a speaker on the actual machine. They didn't come through the TV.
Right.
Pretty slick.
Well, I should say also, before we had anything in our houses, the thing, you know, was arcade games and arcades, right? I mean, that was huge when we were kids, because you didn't have something in your home. You went to an arcade and played Pac-Man or, you know, Tetris at the time, but the one that
Asteroids,
you rotated around.
Battlezone.
Yeah. Asteroids, Battlezone. So that was my original computer gaming experiences before we could do it at home. And then the fact that you could play Pong at home was just amazing. And Pong, for, you know, any of our younger people, is just a ball going back and forth between paddles. but it was still huge. You were playing that at home, you know.
Little funny thing that I don't think a lot of people ever really realized, when Rockstar developed their Rage engine that they still use today, their first demo of it that they released, or their first product they released it in, was Rockstar Table Tennis.
I heard that was a really good game. Yeah.
And it's neat. I've played it. I didn't play a lot of it, but I played some, and it was well done. But that's basically just, you know, modern day Pong. Struck me as amusing that they would demonstrate this engine that powers Grand Theft Auto V on a table tennis game, a Pong game.
So, one of the things that, you know, has been my whole life history is when I get into something like gaming, eventually I want to make the thing that I'm doing, right? And so I started looking for ways to make games, you know, and I found this system that was eventually called Beyond, and that's how I met you.
Originally called Dung.
Yeah. I know. The guys who created were obsessed with the fact that fecal matter can be useful to society, so they called it Dung.
Well, composting. It makes sense. I haven't taken it up yet, but my dog does fertilize the lawn a lot, so there's that.
Eventually, they changed the name to Beyond, which probably made a lot more sense. And I think how we met was, they wrote a book about the language for the game, which was brilliant. I mean, they did an amazing language, which spent the last few years teaching and doing Python. Basically, their gaming language was Python before that existed.
They had adopted, like the use of indentation instead of all those curly braces and all that syntactic sugar, as the hackers call it.
I mean, a lot of people got started with RPG Maker and beyond, just took the concept of RPG Maker, 100 times further. Unfortunately, it never really got the success that it should have. But they did a book, and they asked the two of us to edit the book because we were sort of the best programmers.
Hey, or at least the most mouthy. The
yeah. And I didn't know who you were. I was like, oh, who's this guy? I don't know about him. But, but eventually we ended up working together to make a few games. Well, you had your own game there, the Space Station one.
Well, that wasn't... No, Space Tug was mine. It was like a tribute to Alien, kind of. You're on a spaceship, and things like you could open an airlock, and it would create a vacuum in the ship and suck everything out into space. But Space Station 13, I put that in the notes because that was another... a beyond programmer, and I'm tempted to say it was Tur 13. I don't recall now. I haven't used it for some time, but Space Station 13, if you've heard of anything that Beyond has produced so far, it might very well be Space Station 13, because that's really grown popular, and some big YouTubers have done videos on it, and just how crazy and absurd it can get. It's really a cleverly done game. I never played a lot of it myself, but I've watched some of these videos on it, and it's hilarious, some of the hijinks that people get up to on it.
Well, so, what few people know is that we created the inspiration for Dragon's Dogma, which was a game called Dragon Snot.
Yeah. And that was a cool game. It was one of those pipe flowing games that you
Lucasfilm had done.
I was
pipe
just
going to
say, yeah.
And
Dream, maybe, was it?
Yeah, which I really liked, right? You connected pipes together to try to get things from one end to the other. And so the idea for Dragon Snot was there's a dragon who's asleep and snoring, and his snot is coming out, and you're directing it with these pipes to the end that you need to go to, right? And I really loved that game. I thought it was a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. And now that you mention it... I think that may have cursed me, because I have terrible post-nasal drip now that I wake up every morning and with basically oysters in my sinuses that I have to clear out. But the thing I always think of when I think of that game is at that time, I had a pretty cheap CRT monitor. I just got something that I thought I could afford it, and it worked. So there you go. And I was doing all the art for this game, and after I finally got an LED monitor, I realized that all the colors in that game were not what I had intended, because my monitor had such bad colors.
Now, I will say, we actually created, for a while anyway, the most popular game on Beyond, which is called Last Robot Standing, which was a complete re-skinning of a board game I love.
Ripoff, you mean to say.
Yeah, it calls Wiz Wars.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I thought... So Wiz Wars is about wizards and these... You can have different segments of the board, and the board can be rotated, and all these things can happen, and all this. And we just turned the wizards into robots. But I thought our conversion was really good. It really worked well, mm-hmm. and people loved it. It was one of the most played games on the system.
Oh, yeah, it was pretty slick.
And so I'm kind of proud of that, even though, it was a total ripoff. But, and I have, so many versions of the Wiz War board game.
Oh, yeah.
You had mentioned notes one. Well, our Living and Dead is the first one we did. I don't even want to talk about that. I don't think it was very good. But Birdland was pretty good, because Birdland... So what I was influenced by was these air traffic, there was an air traffic controller game, right, where planes would come in and you'd have to direct them to their location. And of course, more and more planes are coming in and you're having to try to get them all going in the right place. So we did Birdland, where birds are coming in and you had to do it. And it was a lot of fun. I enjoyed that game. And of course, the birds would hit each other you had to do the graphics where their you know, feathers were going all over the place after they hit each other. And all
that. Yeah, that was a neat one. It was sort of like a combination of the radar screen aesthetic with little animated cartoon birds going through it. That was cute. Yeah. And it was fun. I played a few rounds of that.
So, you know, eventually, I mean, our time with that came to an end, and but we stayed connected, which I appreciate, because I mean basically, to be honest, you're my longest term friend at this point that came out of all this.
Well, I have some older friends, but I don't know if I have any better. So there you go. There's your compliment for the year.
And we did eventually then start playing some games together.
Yeah, we played a fair bit of co-op games. Borderlands, I think we played many hours of that. Mm-hmm. And I put in my notes that sometimes we have some differences in taste. Like, I know you love Factorio, and yeah. I played enough to see that it's a well-made game. I mean, I have nothing but respect for the game, but it's just not my cup of tea, personally. You know, I'm more the open-world exploration type of guy.
It's a very specific kind of game, but it does take over my brain. I mean, I spent recently probably a year playing that and doing nothing else and not doing work and not doing other things. and then I stopped playing and doing other things, but they're about to come out with the next version of the game. But it's so I'll probably put more time into it. But you know, I also feel like somehow we all missed things doing Beyond, because you could have done something like Factorio Beyond and you know, we didn't, but it's an amazing game, and it's a game that's really about programming. It's not that you're actually programming, but you're creating items and then getting them to flow into other items, and you know, it's really interesting, but.
So I imagine there's some kind of thing probably you could make the equivalent of a Turing machine in Factorio.
What I call Factorio is Minecraft for adults, right? Because you can do many, it could be a train game. I mean, you can just make a train system if that's what you're interested in. Mm-hmm. Or you could do all, you know, you could create, sort of like in Minecraft, you could create a whole system, a computer that did other things. I mean, yeah, it's just amazing what you can do. So I think it's a great and educational game. I think kids would learn a lot, especially about programming from playing it, even though you're not programming. So in programming, there's the idea of, when do you just do something to get it done, and when do you refactor things to make it better? Well, in Factorio, you have these alien bugs attacking you. So you just need to put together the machinery to create the things you need to hold off the bugs, right?
Right.
But at some point, you need to refactor it to make it work better. And that's what programming is all about, right? Mm-hmm. Your boss calls you and you need something by tomorrow morning versus you need to fix things and change them and make it work better for the future. Right.
Yeah, you have these little emergencies that pop up that distract you from what you really think you should be doing. Yeah. Right. Just like real life.
Yeah. Well, and also kind of like Dragon's Dogma.
Yeah, it's a class one emergency.
So we played Dragon's Dogma 1, which is what, like 12 years ago? So.
Yeah. In 2012. Yep.
It's not the weird thing about Dragon's Dogma is it is a single player game, but you actually are interacting with other players, because a player has their own character, and then they have a pawn.
Right.
And that pawn is available to all other people who are playing the game.
Right. And there's a bit of advertising involved because you want to get your pawn hired by other players. So you try to give it good skills and you try to make it either good looking or funny, or based on a celebrity, you know, something that will give people a hook, a reason to hire it, because the more people who hire it, the more Rift crystals you get, which means you can hire, with Rift crystals, you can hire pawns that are above your level and they can just go to town for you. So it's it's a really neat, clever system, I think. And that worked the same, pretty much the same in Dragon's Dogma 1 as in this one.
The whole point of Dragon's Dogma is there are small creatures out there.
Goblins, wolves,
But there are a lot of big creatures, you know, griffins and cyclops and et cetera, and you're fighting them. What was different about Dragon's Dogma 1 is that so many of these fights are what would be the boss fight in any other game, right? Mm-hmm. This huge thing, it takes half an hour to take it down. That would be the end of the game, right? But that's just another fight in Dragon's Dogma. Like, you're going to have hundreds and hundreds of those.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I don't remember that much about the first game. I certainly didn't finish it. You know, I think I felt like the controls were a bit awkward and everything, and I never played the expansion. Now, I know, you know, just now from looking at different things about Dragon's Dogma, a lot of people say that the expansion to Dragon's Dogma, what was it called? The something...
Bitter Black Isle, I think, if I remember.
Corrupted Avatar or something, you know.
Oh, Dark Arisen. Yeah,
that's it. Dark Arisen.
And then the region that opened up was called Bitter Black Isle.
Yeah, so Dark Arisen, for many people, is considered to be the great game, right? Well, I never played that because I only played the original. I didn't play the expansion. Did you play?
You know, I did play some of that. I played the main story multiple times, but I never got to the end of Bitter Black Isle. It was a big leap in difficulty. And now, you know, I might go back to it actually someday and just see what I can do, because I did kill at least one big evil monster in that, and it was pretty tough. It was a near run thing. I never did finish that expansion, but I did play the main game multiple times just because it was fun to try the different vocations and, you know, see what's going on. And then there are the quests I missed on the first playthroughs because I had no idea what to do, which was, you know, you mentioned you got to a point in Dragon's Dogma 2, as I did, where the game basically tells you, are you sure you want to do this? You might want to talk to your friends first and see if they've had any learning to give you about that. And that was basically, that is unchanged from Dragon's Dogma 1, where there's quests. And I think Elden Ring had this too, where there's stuff in there that you could never figure out on your own unless you're some kind of savant, you know, and just persisted through multiple replays. But so I kept going back to the game to just because the action is so much fun, and I'm not usually an action guy, you know, that's not what I focus on in a game, but it's so much fun with Dragon's Dogma, and there's so many things you can do because you can switch freely between your classes or vocations, you know, fighter, thief, archer, etc., and we'll go into those a little more. And then you have the composition of your party. You know, you've got your main sidekick pawn, and then you can hire up to two other pawns. So depending on what kind of party you put together, well, maybe you've got a support mage as your main pawn, and then you hire a fighter and a thief, or maybe you hire an archer and a warrior who is like a fighter who does the heavier wind-up moves. And maybe you just go with a party of three archers, you know, or whatever. You might mix and match and see what they do. And it's just fun to keep experimenting with all that. I really enjoyed it, and I loved the fact that character creator gave you such fine level of detail to, because I'm the kind of player who, spends a fair amount of time in the character creator in just about any game that offers me one. And the Dragon's Dogma 1 character creator was especially good. You had a lot of variety. And one of the things, in fact, that it's a very minor complaint because we've seen that the character creator in this game can do amazing things, but they changed one core thing about it, which was that in the first one, the character creator was basically Mr. Potato Head. You know, you pick a preset body, a preset head, base head, and then you've got choose a different pair of eyes, a different nose, different chin, different mouth, different ears, different hairstyle, so on. So everything that you're picking is limited to the selections that they offer you, but they give you such a variety of them that you could pretty much create whatever you wanted. Whereas in this one, my understanding is that all the base heads in this one are taken from scans of real heads. And then you have sliders that let you adjust things to oftentimes to absurd levels if you wanted to go that route. But also the fact that they're all based on actual heads means that there are going to be some gaps where maybe exactly the thing you want, you can't quite get even putting some sliders to the extreme. Right. Now, I think if somebody who was better at it probably wouldn't be terribly limited by it. But for me, it's, you know, I did actually end up with both my Arisen and my main pawn. I'm very happy with them now. You know, every once in a while I'll go back and, you know, move the cheeks in 10 slider points or something like that. But basically I'm very happy with them now. But it's not... I think the system in the first game was slightly better overall. Hmm. If they could combine that and give you those base parts and then give you some sliders to apply to them, that might be the best of both worlds.
Yeah, so my character on my second run through, I changed to one of the cat. They're called Beastrins, right? One of the basically cat creatures. He looked much better previously in my previous run. And then, so one of the complaints I'll make is before the game came out, they released the character creation system. Right. And you could create your character and your pawn. And then when the game came out, you could use those.
Right. And save you an hour of, you know, diddling around when you want to get into the new game.
And originally, they didn't have any ability to start a new game. You just had your character, and that's it. And you couldn't start a new game. Because of so many complaints, shortly after the game was released, they updated it, and now you can start from scratch.
Right.
But one of the things they screwed up in that is that it doesn't say, do you want to use the character from your last game?
Oh,
it
right.
only offers you, do you want to use your character from the character creator?
Ah, and you had made tweaks to the character.
Oh, yeah. So I could not use my character appearance from the last game, which I think is just a bug. It's just a mistake because they hadn't designed the game to allow for the new thing, and they didn't think about the fact that you might want to use from your last playthrough, right?
Yeah.
So I had to recreate him. He's called Aslan because from
Narnia.
Chronicles of Narnia. My previous Aslan looked much better, and I don't have him quite right yet in this one, and I wish I could have inherited him. Now, honestly, I don't want to spend a lot of time on these because they'll change over time. But we do have some controversies. You know, people jumped on this game when it came out because the performance is bad on PCs on a number of things. Now, I will say, and I don't know your experience, but I do. I have about a year and a half old, really nice gaming computer.
Mm-hmm.
I slightly noticed the performance problems in a city, but it's never really impacted me. And I understand that on other systems and everything, it can be much worse. But also, I realize it's going to get better. They'll fix it. I don't, you know.
Yeah, one would hope. I'm playing at 1080p and I still get that. It's not massive slowdown. It goes down from, I have it capped at 60 and it goes down to 40 or 50 sometimes. But the thing is, and I think I mentioned this to you before, just in our own conversations, I watched a Digital Foundry video on the graphics, and they make really interesting videos about that sort of thing. And what they mentioned was that the problem with the performance in the cities is not so much the frame rate drop, because it still stays around, 40 or 50 or so, which is nice and smooth. But what it does is that the gaps between frames are irregular, and that prevents mm-hmm. your mind from getting that illusion of smooth movement.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more distracting than it should be at the frame rate that you're getting. But it is ultimately a minor thing. And then perversely, when you get out into the big open world, that's when things run a lot smoother most of the time.
Mm.
And what they say that is it's CPU bound. It's not your graphics card that's the limit. It's your processor, your central processor, because all the pawn AI and all the NPC AI is, trying to do not only their basic walking around stuff, but also like collision detection, because there's a lot of ragdolling in physics in this game. So there's a lot of that stuff that goes with every individual character in the world. When you're in a city, of course, there's a ton of them around, so it adds up faster.
We should describe the basic gameplay, right? And so you choose a vocation, which is a class, as we said, and there are a whole number of vocations that either a pawn or an arisen that, your character can do. And there are also special vocations that only an arisen can do. And then you just go out into the world, and there are quests and everything and storyline, but it doesn't really matter. What this game is about is you go out in the world and you encounter everything from, goblins who are just annoyances, little creatures that annoy you, to griffins and cyclops and, Medusa and all this, or these major monsters that you have to fight.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, and drakes, which are kind of mini dragons. And ultimately, you're going to fight the really big dragon, which is, much more significant than the drakes.
Right.
And really, the game is about just going out and exploring the world and fighting these kinds of monsters. And then also, the thing I would describe this kind of game as is it is a story generator, right? Because whatever happens, happens. So there's all these different systems in place, and really bizarre things will happen. So, for example, in my case, so there are these points, these things where you can recruit pawns.
Riftstones, yeah.
So most of them you bring up a system where you can look at a whole bunch of different pawns that match a certain criteria for that riftstone, and you can choose one if you want. Some of them just bring up a pawn that you might want to recruit.
Yeah, the ones in the cities let you do selective searches, and then the ones you find out in the wild tend to have a theme, big pawns or small pawns or male pawns.
Right, but then some of them, they just a pawn appears in front of you, and you can choose whether or not to recruit some of those. So I got one of those, right, and it's the first time it ever happened to me. And that's one of the things I love about the game. And one reason I would say, if you're going to play this game, don't listen to us. Don't listen to any YouTube channel. Just play the game, because it'll be so much more fun to just see what happens. So anyway, I did one of these rift things where it was just, a pawn appeared in front of me. And it was the first time I'd ever had that happen. And it was a high-level pawn for me. It was really good, and I hired him. And it was going great because this pawn, you know, was excellent and could help me do all these fights and everything.
Cleaning the house.
Yeah. And then we had this fight where in the process of the fight, this pawn happened to injure a pig. And the pig got pissed off and charged the pawn and hit him. Well, the pawn was right next to a river with a waterfall. So he falls into the water and goes over the waterfall. And also, in this game, water is special and sort of tends to kill people anyway. So
the brine, yeah, we'll get to that.
So this pawn who had helped me so much just died. And I'm like, well, I understand how games work. I'm just going to run along and eventually he'll reappear in my list. But that's not how this game works. So this, on the one hand, I'm going to say this game is not hard in a certain way, but it is cruel. Right? Like, whatever happens, happens. So that pawn died. And he was gone.
Yep.
And I had to get a different pawn, or, you know, maybe I could ask for him back again in a certain circumstance or whatever. But when I say it's a story generator, it's like, that's a story, right? Oh, we were doing this thing, and my pawn got pushed into the water, and then he died. And these stories are all unique, and that's what's great about this game, is it generates these amazing stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's probably one of the things I liked about the first one, too, is that it worked very similarly. Yeah, you'd have just unexpected, you know, it's what people mean. You know, you hear interviews with developers who talk about the emergent gameplay, and Dragon's Dogma 2 has that in spades, I would say.
Oh, God, yeah. Well, for example, so most quests and in most games, right? Well, if you fail the quest, it'll just reset and you can do it again. Not in Dragon's Dogma 2, right? So most quests you can do whenever you want, but some quests are time oriented and they'll make that clear. They'll have a little hourglass thing next to the quest. So you've got to do it soon. Now, when I played through, and I was a total moron the first time through. So first of all, the game, so you, between you and the YouTube stuff I'd watched, I was convinced I wanted to try this game. And it dropped like late at night. So I'm like half drunk already. And I download the game. So I don't remember any of the, you know, text that it gave me or prompts or whatever. And so it's like, oh, my son was taken by these wolves. You need to go. And I'm like, okay, fine. I'll get around to it. I got other stuff to do. And I spend the next couple hours doing other stuff. And then I finally go and do the, you know, the wolves took my son quest. And the son is dead. Because I took too much time and the wolves ate him.
Yeah. That happens.
And that's the kind of game this is, right? Like, And so then what that made me do was there's another quest where a woman says, oh, my husband is out there somewhere and you need to go save him. And it's a time oriented quest. And I'm like, oh, my God. And I haven't uncovered that portion of the map.
Mm-hmm.
So I rush out there and do everything I can to get to where he is. But then I'm totally underpowered. I'm trying up a new class and everything. I don't really know how to use it. And in the fight, he dies because I screwed up. I wasn't good enough. I didn't know how to use my class. I wasn't powered up enough. And he's dead. So now I had to go back to his wife and say, he died. And so this is a game that, like, it just generates these stories, right? It's not... And one of the things I appreciate about it, because, you know, you look at, like, Spider-Man or whatever and all these games, right? And I love Spider-Man, especially the first game. But they have fast travel, and they have all these things, and nothing ever really goes wrong, right? You can always reset it if something...
Yeah.
You can always redo it if something goes wrong. But in this game, it's like, well, you didn't go save the kid. He got ate by the wolves. That's how it goes.
Yeah, better luck next playthrough.
Exactly.
And that's something that's probably worth mentioning, is this game is like the first one. This game is designed with the hope that you will want to go back and do multiple playthroughs. That's probably why the story is fairly short, you know, so you can get through it in a reasonable time
and frame. You know, we talk about how it's a lot bigger than Dragon's Dogma 1, but I would say it's still fairly small in that there are like two major areas. I mean, there's not, and then there's an end game whole thing. First of all, Elden Ring, in terms of art design and amazement, just is very different and way larger. Like, you would just incredible vistas and incredible things. You would go to a little building and then go down the stairs, and all of a sudden a whole new world would open up and it would be amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Art design wise, just so incredibly different and better than Dragon's Dogma. But one of the problems, I never finished Elden Ring because it was just like, oh, here's another huge vista. Oh, here's another huge vista. Like, I couldn't get a sense of the structure of the game. Like, is this ever going to end? So Dragon's Dogma 2 is actually, I would argue, relatively small, but this comes back to what I learned playing like Hades, which is if you can understand the whole of the game and the structure of the game, you can replay it and then try to optimize certain things. Or this time I'm going to do it this way. This time I'm going to do it that way.
Yeah.
But if the game is 10 times larger, like, okay, you just get lost. I mean, it just, you know, so... Yeah.
Although there are people who do know Elden Ring at that level of complexity,
sure.
But it's almost a vocation in itself to learn it at that depth. Yeah. I played Elden Ring for I don't know exactly. I'm thinking probably around 35 hours, and I wanted to have that be the From Software game that I really finally got around to finishing, and I just don't think I'm going to do it. And it's not because it's a bad game. It's, you know, like Factorio, it's a game that's very well done, and I did enjoy quite a bit of it, and the character creator was actually pretty good in that, too. The thing that got to me about it wasn't the difficulty. I mean, I didn't mind once I accepted that I'm just going to die a lot, and, you know, I got to keep at it. You know, I kept going and grinding and making incremental progress, and you know, I finally got to the point where I beat a couple of the early smaller big bosses, and it was going well. But I got to the point where I started exploring the world more, and I guess the thing that bothered me was that the world in that game is so relentlessly grim. Like, this Dragon's Dogma 2 is a grim world where, you know, because the Arisen and the dragon have come back, they always come back together. Or the dragon comes back and then creates the Arisen shortly afterwards. And so from that point on, the world kind of takes a turn for the worse, and there's all these monsters on the roads trying to kill everybody, where before they were kind of just living out in nature and keeping to themselves and so forth. So it is a grim world, but it's a different kind of grimness. There's also the, you know, there's lightheartedness, there's just, you know, refreshing nature, and there's, I don't know, it's a nicer world to be in overall, even though it is still a grim world. And I think that's why I kind of eventually bounced off Elden Ring a little, where I'm still getting a kick out of this one. But it's just, they're tonally a little bit different in some way, even though they're both basically the world is screwed scenarios.
Well, one difference I'd say is Elden Ring is hard. Dragon's Dogma is hard when you start, but it really gets easy as you level up. And it's not hard as a game. But it's just a lot of fun because all these different vocations have these great skills, and it's a lot of fun killing these guys. And then say, because it's not that long, there's not, I mean, especially once you played through it the first time. The first time you played, I mean, basically, it's an exploration game, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the whole point of that kind of game is that the game designers need to give you reasons to go everywhere.
Right.
And there's a whole, it's funny because one of the controversies about the game is fast travel. Like, oh, they do or they don't or whatever. There is fast travel in the game, although, as I mentioned to you in one of my texts, I would say this is the first game to create slow travel. So the typical mode of travel are these caravans, and normally the whole point of fast travel is you just go from one point to another and you don't have to worry about anything between. This is the reverse, right? So first of all, you can choose to simply watch the caravan that you're sitting in go along for half an hour.
Oh, yeah.
But the idea is that you can choose to doze off, so you go to sleep. Now, if nothing happens between where you are and the destination, then you just show up at the destination, and that's fast travel.
Yeah.
But 90% of the time, your caravan will get attacked, and you'll have to wake up and help fight off people. And then, and I love this, right? And I think, again, it's really an exploration game because what'll happen is like, oh, I'm taking a caravan from here to here. Well, then you get attacked and you fight off a Cyclops or whatever. But at the end, the Cyclops falls over and destroys the cart.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, those carts are pretty fragile for being made out of wood.
Or the driver runs away, or the driver gets killed, or the ox gets killed. You know, anything could happen, right? And now you're like halfway between where you were and where you wanted to go, and you're like, fuck, I'm screwed.
Yeah, and it might be after midnight, so the skeletons and
Exactly. And well, now I just have to go manually, right? But that's perfect because it's an exploration game. So what happens is you end up out in the middle of nowhere, and now you have to explore. And you find out a cave that you didn't know existed, and then, you know, you fight an interesting monster in there, and you get some interesting loot. And they have, the designers said, the whole point of all the quests and everything in this game is to get you trying to go from point A to point B, but then you get screwed up, and you have to explore.
Oh, right? Yeah.
The whole point is you can't get where you're going, and you've just got to deal with that.
Yeah. And that's another fun thing about the pawns is they'll pick up things like, you know, somebody else hires them and goes to a cave you haven't been in before. Mm-hmm. Well, the next time you're in the vicinity, your pawns say, "Master, you know, when I was out in the rift, I found a cave near here. Would you like me to show you the way?" And if you look at them and press your go, you know, there's a D-pad instruction for different pawn strategies. And if you choose go, then that pawn will lead you to that cave, and you've got a new cave to explore now. So that's pretty cool. And on the ox carts, I wanted to mention my first trip in an ox cart, I was going to ride the whole way. You know, there's an early mission where basically you go from one town to another. You get to the town, and you meet somebody who says, "Hey, I need you to go to deliver a message to the person in this town that you were just in." So I'm like, "Oh, perfect. I'll take an ox cart." And I figure, it's going to be a Red Dead Redemption 1 stagecoach ride, because in, you know, Red Dead Redemption 2, they kind of skip over the stagecoach ride. But at 1, you could actually ride all the way and look at what's going on. And the ox carts theoretically work the same way. You know, you might have to get up and get off the cart and fight a little to protect it here and there. But in theory, you could ride the ox cart all the way to your destination. In practice, though, the first time I tried riding it, and a couple times thereafter, what happened was I was just sitting there watching the scenery go by, and, you know, I hear a little cry off in the distance, you know, some monster roar, you know, type thing. And the next thing you know, this griffin kamikazes down into the cart, which kills, destroys the ox cart and sends me flying out of it and kills me too. So listen for those sound cues when you're riding in the ox cart.
One of the things I love about this game is it forces you to rethink how you play games. So just like I was saying, like, oh, it's a timed mission and you didn't go there in time and the kid died, right? You can't, there's nothing you can do. The kid died. one of the things they do here is they have all these classes and you can vocations and you can switch between them at any time and you can level them up and all that. So you can play in different ways. So one of the reasons they didn't provide different save slots, even though I have issues with that, they don't want you to restart. They just want you to change class and try that out and maybe then change your pawns class if necessary.
And they do a clever thing to give you incentive to do that changing, which is each class gets these augments, which are like passive abilities, you know, bonuses, perks, whatever you want to call them. But each vocation has a different set of them that you earn by advancing through the ranks up to rank 9, I think, is the highest. Mm-hmm. And so each time you go through a class, you're getting these new augments. And then you switch to another class. Well, if that one class gave you an augment that recovers stamina faster, for instance, well, that's something that's pretty much universally applicable. So now because you played that class, you can apply that augment in your new class if you want to, which, you get like 6 augment slots that you can fill with anything that you've unlocked. And you unlock them by playing the vocation. So it's kind of a clever system, I think.
Yeah. It encourages you to change it up, not only for yourself, but for your pawn, because you want to max out, you know, whatever they're doing. Also, the different vocations play very differently, right? I screwed up everything when I started these games. And so not only did I not pay attention to any of the documentation that was popping up telling me how things worked and everything, I started as a mage. The mage is the one class that you really don't want to play as the primary character. Because the mage is really just a healer. So first of all, because I was, you know, half drunk and ignoring all this stuff, I didn't understand adding skills to the vocation. I didn't, etc. And so I just had one little thing that I could send a little bolt out to the person that I was attacking. I didn't understand that I was a healer, and I didn't understand the way healing works. So I was really confused, and I'm playing like a dozen hours, and I'm really confused because all of the health on all my characters, you know, the pawns and myself, are going down, and I don't understand what's going on. Well, the deal is, if you don't rest at a campsite or an inn, every time you have a fight and you get damaged, your top level of health goes down.
Right. And a hard hit will really knock it down, and a softer hit will not just take it down a sliver.
You need to rest at a campsite or at an inn to repair this. But I didn't understand it. But also, I didn't realize that I could go to a, you know, vacation guy and add to my skills. So for like the first dozen or 16 hours, I'm going through with one little, and me and my pawn, with one little attack and one little whatever and not extending it. By the time I figured out vocations, I had so many points to use that I could just do whatever I wanted. But I also enjoy that. I mean, I enjoy playing a game where, like, you don't know how it works and you're trying to figure it out, and it makes harder and it takes longer.
And I will say, I haven't played the mage in this game yet. That's one of the few classes I haven't done. But I did play it in the original, and I think they're the same principle, you know, the healer. It's basically a healer, but you do have some other stuff. You do have some offensive spells, and you have the buffs that, like, give
magic. They're mostly a buffer, right? Because, they add these magic skills like fire or ice or whatever to your attacks. And if you have a pawn doing this, I think they'll try to be intelligent. Like, if they know that this particular kind of enemy is vulnerable to ice, then they'll add ice to your attacks. But, that's not a really fun thing to play. You want your pawn or some other pawn playing that because it's purely support. And that's the one I started with.
And speaking of the classes that a lot of people don't like to play, I wanted to mention the trickster, which I also think of as the jackass, because you basically the idea of the trickster is you don't have any attacks that do any substantial damage. Your goal is to draw aggression and just basically run around the battlefield like Daffy Duck, you know, going woohoo, woohoo, and drawing the enemy's attention. And you also, the trickster has the ability to buff people also, you know, and it seems to be pretty significant, the amount of buff that it gives to your fellow party members. So you may actually find when you start playing the trickster that if you're good at it and you can keep the attention of the enemies, the pawns, meanwhile, are freed up to do their thing, and they will just go to town on the enemies.
Right, because you can create a ghost image of yourself if you do it right, the bad guy will be attacking your ghost image.
Right.
While your pawns are attacking the bad guy. You know, it confused me for a bit when I did the trickster, and then I realized, you know, this is really the enchanter class, like in World of Warcraft, right? Your job is to control characters, not to damage them.
You haven't played World of Warcraft, but I'll take your word for it.
Now, and I mean, every one of these classes is amazing. So Thief, this is a high damage, you know, they can do all these different things. One of the best things they have is what's called the Ensnare ability, right? Where so if one of these goddamn birds, I hate the birds so much. So the bird comes by, or harpy or whatever, they can, you know, grab it with a hook and pull it down.
Right.
Because one of the things these bird things do is they have this sleep ability. So they're circling around, causing everyone to fall asleep.
Yeah, you'll see a blue aura build up on your character, and if you don't get out of their range fast enough, you're going to take a nap.
But then the thief can just pull them down, and everybody can beat on them. And the thief just has all sorts of great... I mean, it's a very fun class. Now, my pawn is Jackie Brown, and I'm making her a thief because I think that's appropriate for that character. Mm. And she just goes out and murders these people. Sorcerer, now, oh my god, the sorcerer is so powerful. And the funny thing in this game is they truly, so, you know, the sorcerers can bring in a hurricane or bring down meteors and all this, and it can actually mess you up because you're trying to attack somebody and all of a sudden meteors are hitting and you can't see anything, you know, or there's a hurricane and you can't see anything. You're trying to attack somebody. It's like, but these are extremely powerful spells. The sorcerers are amazing. I always have a sorcerer and a thief in my party.
Yeah. And the drawback to the sorcerer is that it has a long wind up time. You know, it might take 10 seconds to cast a really powerful spell.
In the meantime, they get interrupted or hit. And so I'm always having to, you know, bring them back from death because you, as the Arisen, are the only person who can bring people back from death.
Yeah. It's, I mean, the Mystic Spear Hand, I don't think we touched on that one. And it's like a two-bladed spear, kind of like Darth Maul type of thing. And on top of that, he has this shield ability that can protect not only him, but other members of the party if they're close enough within range.
That's huge, and that's what I had to learn to use, right? Because what happens is he creates a shield around everyone, and the next three or four attacks don't impact them. And that's huge. And until I was using that, wasn't doing it right. But the other funny thing about that, and this is also another thing about how the game works, right? One of your very first fights in the game, there's a guy named like Sigur or something.
Mm-hmm.
And if you talk to him and ask the right questions, he will give you the Mystic Spear Hand vocation right at the very beginning of the game.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't talk to him or I didn't ask whatever. So I didn't get that, and I just played to the Mystic Spear Hand is one of those only the Arisen can do it, right? Your pawn can't have that class. So I played this thing for dozens of hours, and I randomly go to a place that I'm exploring to, And this guy shows up, and I talk to him, and then he gives me the Mystic Spear Hand skill. One of the things I love about the game is that because I didn't happen to talk to that guy in the right way, my game was completely different. I was playing the normal things for a long time. I didn't have any of the special ones that only the Arisen could have until 20 hours into the game. But one of the things I learned to love about the game that is so different from other games is most other games, okay, you screw up, you need to restart, or you need to go back to whatever. In this game, if you, so, you know, we talked about this in text, right? There is a quest early on where there's a guy in prison and you need to get him out of prison.
Right.
And, but he's very resistant. And when I first talked to him, also, if you're not in the right state, he doesn't really recognize you as the Arisen. He won't talk to you, etc. So that's what happened. Like, I went to him. He didn't understand who I was. He wouldn't talk to me. So you can gift an NPC something. So he was in jail. So I gifted him the key I'd been given for jail. Well, that did nothing. And it was a huge problem because you need the key, because if you get arrested or anything else happens, you need this key to be able to open your jail cell. So I had given him this key and he wouldn't respond to me. And then I got arrested and then I had to deal with all this crap. And I literally could not progress the quest because I had lost the key because I'd given it to him. And I was texting you about this. I'm like, I'm screwed. But I kept going. And one of the things that's amazing about this game is that if you just keep going, something will come up, right? So then I found a vendor who's considered like a junk vendor, right? I mean, he's kind of like a fence, right? And one of the options in his menu was found items. I'm like, oh, what's that? And I check it out. And it turns out the found items are things that you might have given away or lost that are important to the game. And so this fence guy naturally has come across them.
Oh, yeah.
So I was able to buy back the jail key. And then I was able to go back and finish that quest.
Yeah.
And what I learned from that was, don't worry. You don't have to restart. You don't have to just keep going. So another version of that, which I haven't actually made advantage of yet, but I know about, is there are many, many ways people in the game could die. You might kill an NPC who turns out to be important, or some other event might occur that causes that NPC to die, right? And they're an important NPC in the game. Well, there are morgues in the game you can go to where you can bring back to life an important person.
Yeah, and you need an item to do it, but you get some of those items throughout gameplay, and there's ways to get more of them.
The whole thing is, don't worry, don't stop playing, don't think you need to restart. At some point, you'll be able to fix this. Just keep going.
Yeah, unless it's the boy getting eaten by wolves or something like that.
Well, he's just dead, yes.
Yeah. The wake stone doesn't work on him, I guess. But or maybe there is a way. I haven't had him die on me yet. But I had in my first playthrough, I had at least two quests that I thought either I screwed them up or they're just bugged. Like, I had one where I'm supposed to protect a main character from an assassin, and I failed to find the assassin in time. And afterwards, I'm supposed to talk to the person who tasked me with this protection. And she says she's going to give me a letter this is the person I was protecting. I brought her back to life, actually. And she wrote me a letter to give to this other person, except the letter wasn't in my inventory. So I thought, oh, the quest is bugged. And then probably 15 hours later or more, I end up running into that person who had hired me, because she was basically exiled after, you know, after the everything mm-hmm. went to hell. But I ended up running into her, and a whole new quest line continued for me. So, yeah, there's not everything is as it seems in this game. there's some fun stuff to discover in it. Now, I noticed while we're talking about vocations, you had put in a note for the Magic Archer
with
an exclamation point after it, and I don't think we actually discussed the Magic Archer. So,
well, so there are all these vocations; they all play differently. They're all really fun in one way or another. But here's the thing: so I didn't expect to really like the Archer, and I love the Archer, the just generic Archer that any pawn can play, but then you can unlock the Magic Archer, which I understand was a part of the original game as well. Mm-hmm. And the Magic Archer is just a win button. You just stand back. It doesn't matter if it's a Drake. It doesn't matter if it's the final dragon. You just stand back and shoot your magic arrows at them, and they die. So, you know, but in a way, I almost got, and one of the reasons I finished the game one time. So there's also different kinds of ending to the game too right now. I think that's gotten more popular recently, where if you just play this game the way a game is supposed to be played, so the idea is like, you know, well, you're supposed to be the leader, but you're not, and you go through all this stuff, and at the end you become the leader, right? Well, that is a full playthrough of the game that's totally satisfying. And you can do that. But if you do that, you have missed like half of the game. Because there's another half of the game where if you don't do that, a whole other set of things happens and changes the world and everything else.
Yeah. I haven't done that yet. I know of it, but on my first playthrough, I was just like, I want this. This is going to be the good, satisfying ending that I was promised from the start, and this is what I'm going to do. And so that's exactly what I did.
And Hades has that too. You know, one of my other favorite games. Like, there are multiple points at which you could stop and say, "I am done. I had a good game," but there's actually a whole lot more game if you keep going. And in a way, I think I feel like this is a commentary on what games are, because if you do the natural thing and become the king at the end, well, that's what a game is supposed to be, right? And you're done. But kind of what they're saying is, okay, that's what a game is supposed to be, and but if you do that, it never ends, right? Because the lore of this game is there's a dragon. The dragon takes the heart out of a person who becomes the Arisen. The Arisen eventually kills the dragon. Then there's a new dragon. And I don't know if the Arisen becomes a dragon or whatever.
The cycle begins again sometime
and
after.
It all
that
keeps just going. So if you play this through to where you become the leader, you just perpetuate the cycle.
Right.
If you choose to take a different route, everything goes to hell. The world is kind of destroyed. Everything changes. But that's the real story, because the real story is that you're supposed to change the cycle of history.
Yeah. There's a town called Harv Village where you can meet a crazy old man who, before I say that, I should explain the brine that we had briefly mentioned. Basically, any water above waist deep is going to send out these Lovecraftian tentacles to drag you in and eat you. Because you're arisen, you just end up immediately coming back.
Right. But one of your pawns could get eaten, or better, the monster you're attacking could go into the water and get eaten, and then you get credit for killing the monster.
Yeah, you get experience, but you don't get any of the parts from that monster, which may be crucial to upgrading some piece of gear that you have. And that's that's something that's briefly worth just mentioning as an aside, is that the crafting in this game is some of the most unobtrusive crafting I've seen in a game. You know, I'm not big on crafting games in general. Light crafting I'm okay with, and this game handles it pretty well, I think, in my opinion. It's not terribly burdensome. You know, you can engage with it when you want to, and beyond that, you can forget it. But anyway, back to the brine. So the brine is this thing that is out in any water that's more than waist deep. You know, you have fish that still live in the ocean, and they may just be fish that live close to shore, or maybe the brine doesn't eat the ones that are out in the ocean. I don't know all the details. But you'll meet this old man who has a goal of taking a boat across the brine, and the brine always fights back when boats get out to a certain point, he says. You know, it pushes you back. This old man, if you talk to him for a while, he has some real interesting pearls of wisdom to drop. And he tells you basically that this is not the real world. You know, the real world is more wonderful, but also more fearsome, he says. And so basically, I think he's telling you you're stuck in a video game.
I think
his message. But it's interesting. And this is all as I haven't played the original for a while, but as far as I can recall, this is pretty much consonant with all the lore that was in that game. And in fact, I believe there are some suggestions in this game that the first game actually took place way in the distant past of this game, but I can't say anything in any great depth about that because it's something I've not explored a lot myself. But anyway, that elder in Harv Village is an interesting guy to talk to, and worth checking out. And you need to talk to him multiple times to get all that dialogue. Yeah.
Well, he tells you a bunch of stuff that sounds like gibberish, but turns out to be true, of course. And if you get to the what's called the true ending, he's a big part of the true ending.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, I think, like I said, ultimately, this is a game that challenges your ideas of what a game is and just challenges you to just go out and explore and have fun and not worry so much. You know, there's this whole idea of save scumming, which they're obviously trying to avoid, right? Where, before a tough fight, I'll save and then I'll just redo if I fail. And this game is trying to defeat that. It's like, just have your experience. And it doesn't matter if you fail, something else will happen, or you'll discover something else or whatever, and just keep moving forward. And I think that's really interesting, and I really like that. And, you know, I mentioned, like, with roguelikes, so a roguelike game is a relatively short game that you just keep redoing and tends to be cruel. I feel like this is like that, say, compared to Elden Ring. So we said Elden Ring is huge, and you just keep going and going, and there's amazing stuff in it, but it just never finishes. Well, This has two or three major areas. There are many quests, and you'll have to play the game multiple times to get those quests, but you can get through the game in a relatively short period of time if you want to, and especially once you know how things work. That's what I love about the whole speedrunning concept, right? So, for example, I played to a pretty high level, and because they wouldn't support multiple saves, I decided to start over because, you know, there's this character, this Sphinx in the game, and there are many challenges, and one of them is, can you remember the first time you found this particular kind of thing? And I wanted to restart so that I could know what the first thing I found was, and just redo it all and everything, and have the fun of sort of exploring and all that. Because I will be honest, the state of the game right now, once you've finished the game once or twice, and I finished it twice, I got kind of bored because I could kill anything at any time. And so I kind of wanted to start over to make it hard again and to experience all the parts of the game that I hadn't experienced yet. And I know, you know, I think that they're going to add features to make that easier to do. Because one of the things is, if you're like a speedrunner, you want to be able to have, like, okay, I played through all this and I have this very high level character. But you also want to be able to have another save where you're starting from scratch and you're speedrunning, right?
Right.
To see how fast you can get through. But doing that, you don't want to give up the dozens and dozens of hours put into the game to get, you know, so you really want, but one of the, and I understand, and I think they said they're going to support multiple saves. One of their issues is they don't want you to have 10 different characters with 10 different pawns, because these pawns are all part of the world.
Right.
So if everybody has 10 different pawns, it kind of explodes it, right?
Yeah. I would think they could mitigate it just by only advertising the current pawn that you're using. But
yeah.
I did notice when I looked at, you know, there's an option to view friends' pawns at some of the big city Riftstones. And I noticed I could see two different versions of Jackie in there. And I think I hired the new one just to give her a little boost. You
know, well, I appreciate that. I had no idea you could do both. But the other benefit of having a friend is, so normally, if you want to hire a pawn that's way higher level than you, you'll have to pay a bunch of what are called rift crystals, right? But if you have a friend and they have a high level pawn, you can hire it for free. Right. So that's essentially a buff or, you know, workaround. So if you had multiple friends that are in the game, you could have these high level pawns that are helping, you know, level you up.
Yeah, I think when you started over, I was probably like level 60 something maybe, and you had that access to that high level pawn for free. Now it was probably, probably she wasn't configured ideally for you, but she was still a high level pawn.
Yeah. Now, I think we talked about it a bit earlier, but I'll come back to what I call the shit happens. So, you know, there's a disease that pawns can get. So when you attack drakes or dragons, one of the things they will occasionally do is they'll grab a pawn and they'll stare at it. And that seems to corrupt the pawn, right? So there's multiple levels of corruption. So it's probably two or three times if they get grabbed and stared at, they become converted and they start refusing orders and not paying attention to you or being jerks.
Yeah. Well, they can also get that, I think, from other pawns who have gotten it. Then I think the drakes also have, some of the drakes have pustules on them that ooze this nasty stuff. I don't know. There's a lot I don't know about the details of it, but the point is you got to watch out for it.
So the thing is, as they're getting infected, the pawn's eyes will get more and more red.
Yeah.
And if you're, especially if you've never experienced it before, you won't notice. But if you don't notice, well, the next time, if they're fully red, the next time you rest at an inn, they will go crazy and kill everybody in the area that you rested at. So all the NPCs are dead.
Yeah, whatever main town that you happen to be in.
Yeah. It could be a lot of people. So I knew about this from YouTube, and I was trying to avoid it, but I still missed it at least at one point and killed everybody in the area. Now, in the nature of the game, of course, you can fix it. You can go to a morgue, and you can spend a lot of money to, you know, resurrect characters in that city that you needed. But the whole idea is you don't pay attention to this, things could go really bad. And the funny thing is, once you know what to look for, and in fact, it was funny because you at one point had my pawn in your party, and then you texted me and said, I think she's got a problem. And I looked at her eyes, and she did. you know, her pupils are red. It wasn't her whole eyes, but her pupils are red. So then what you have to do is you have to kill your pawn. So I threw off a cliff, or you could throw in the water with the brine or whatever.
And once the brine kill them, seems to be a reliable way from what I've read.
Yeah. So that was pretty humorous.
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah. And we have notes. There's so much more we talk about. What are your kind of concluding comments here?
No, boy, I'm just really having a lot of fun with it. I'm still, I mean, it's been out, what, almost 3 weeks now, maybe? And I'm still having fun with it, and I've been putting all the time I can into it, you know, which is what I typically do, especially if it's like a new open world game that really grabs my attention. That's sort of my sweet spot. And I wanted to mention, you know, you had said that Elden Ring's art direction was superior. I guess probably Elden Ring is overall graphically a little bit more refined, or maybe somewhat, I don't know, to some degree it's more refined than this game. But I do love the art direction in this. There's a lot of, you know, just beautiful vistas and, you know, walking through valleys and farmlands. And, you know, I enjoy the experience of being in the world. And that's a big thing for me with an open world game, is the the mise-en-scene, I guess you'd say. Just the feeling of the setting. Yeah, overall, I played the original Dragon's Dogma, played through the story multiple times. I think actually I originally played it on a console, and then when the PC version finally came out, I did it all over again. And I think this is a worthy successor. You know, I would complain a little about the performance issues that they have. It's, I mean, for the computer that I have, playing it 1080p, I should be able to have 60 FPS everywhere, pretty much. And right now, it's not achieving that, as we discussed. But I think they'll probably mitigate that in time. It would have been nice if they'd done it before release, but what are you going to do? I wanted to touch very briefly on the controversy of the microtransactions, if only to say, you don't need the microtransactions for anything. Everything they're selling you, there might be one or two items that are like little nice things that you can't get in the game, but there's nothing in the microtransactions that you need to play this game and enjoy it. If you don't like that aspect of it, I can understand it. I mean, microtransactions are kind of a cynical, weaselly type of thing, you know, where you buy yourself a game for $70 or whatever. You know, there's one of my favorite quotes from Max Payne 3, which came out a week before the original Dragon's Dogma, actually, is, say what you want about Americans, but we understand capitalism. You buy yourself a product and you get what you paid for. And I think you do get what you paid for with Dragon's Dogma 2. The microtransactions are not necessary, unless you just really, really want to spend some extra money. Forget about them. You won't need them.
Well, and I bought the expensive version of the game that included the microtransactions.
I did that too. I mean, the deluxe edition.
Yeah. It's made no difference to the gameplay. So people are worried about that. I understand the concern, but it really, you know, this game has nothing to do with that. So before we close out, let's talk about the whole, again, fast travel, etc. Because modern games have started to have this fast travel mechanic at some point where you can just go anywhere. You know, I use it and whatever. But the creator of this game has said that he prefers that people find it interesting to go around the game. And it's true in that there are different fast travel. There are multiple fast travel mechanisms in the game. So anyone who says there's no fast travel is just bullshit. You know, you have the carts. But not only do you have the carts, in the other area, you have these sky, it's like the ski things, right? Where you
The gondola type sky ride things, yeah.
But the difference between most games, so like let's say Spider-Man, where you have fast travel, okay, you just go here, and you avoid everything in between. If you do the gondolas, there are always these goddamn birds that are attacking you.
And griffins, too. I mean, just like the ox card. I mean, a griffin is liable to come out of the sky. I did successfully travel from one point to another in one of those once, and I did it by traveling at night, where apparently maybe the creatures couldn't see me.
Yeah, that makes sense, right. When I first did one of those gondolas in a key area, I was annoyed because I looked at the map and I realized I skipped exploring this whole area of the map, which means I missed out on all of the loot and all of the, you know, monsters that I could have leveled up with. Like, it was not a benefit to skip over a part of the map. It was a negative because going through that part of the map would give you a whole bunch of experience and a whole bunch of exploration and interest in caves and all the rest of that. So, you know, it's almost funny. Like, the fast travel is almost a negative in this game.
Yeah, although you can't always go back to that unexplored area and explore it. So, you know, it's not a complete loss.
Well, so we talked about all sorts of stuff. There's, you know, we could double this. But we have to come down to, so is it worth playing?
To my tastes, it definitely is. I'm enjoying the hell out of it. It's there's sort of a good-natured wackiness to it, on top of having a beautiful world to go around in. And I don't know, it's just something about it, just like the first one. There's something about it that just hits the right notes with me. So I would say if you're on the fence about it, if you're just curious about it, you know, watch some YouTube reviews or whatever. Maybe watch good ones and bad ones. You know, make up your own mind. But to my tastes, it's definitely worth playing.
And, you know, the first one didn't grab me enough to play it all the way through. Maybe now I regret that. I think I would have enjoyed it if I had. Mm. But this one absolutely just grabs me. I could, you know, I can't even fully explain. I put dozens and dozens of hours into it already, and I'm certainly going to put more. I know even from listening to YouTube things, there's so many things that I missed, that so I just want to keep playing. And as I kind of mentioned, because it's not the size and scope of, say, Elden Ring, you can actually, you know, do everything at some point, right? Like, you can encompass it, where Elden Ring for me was like, okay, it's just so much more and I can't deal with it. Even though I loved many aspects of that game.
Nothing I've said in here should be taken as a disparaging Elden Ring. It's just not quite what gelled with me.
Right. So I think I will keep coming back to this and trying different approaches and all that. And so, yeah, absolutely worth playing.
Well, good. We found a good one this time.
Okay, next week, probably a Doctor Who thing.
Yay!